painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking. KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Poetry is an art form in itself, and today on Artbeat, we have a local authority on it.
My name is Ken McCullough. I'm Winona's Poet Laureate.
Throughout Ken's career, he has been the recipient of many awards, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, and the New Millennium Poetry Award are just a few of the many. Ken has also received travel grants that helped a joint project with U Sam Ur, a survivor of the Pol Pot regime in Cambodia. Together, the two worked to publish U's works with Ken's translations. Today, Ken will talk to us about how he found himself in poetry, advice to others looking to do the same, and how life experiences contribute to his writing. We caught up with Ken at the Frozen River Film Festival in Winona, Minnesota at Winona State University. We go there now to hear Ken present his work he wrote for the festival regarding garbage as an opening presentation to the film Wasteland.
Good morning. Thank you for being here. I would like to dedicate the poem I'm going to read to our mayor, Jerry Miller. Last Saturday morning, I sat down out at Miller's Scrap Metal and Salvage and talked recycling philosophy with Jerry. And a number of those, Jerry's insights are woven into this poem. And it has an epigraph from Hamlet. Most of you will recognize this. This is Hamlet talking to Horatio, you know, when he's looking at the skull of Yorick. Why may not imagination trace the noble dust of Alexander till he find it stopping a bunghole? Alexander died. Alexander was buried. Alexander returneth into dust. The dust is earth, of earth we make loam, and why of that loam, whereto he was converted, might they not stop a beer barrel? Imperious Caesar, dead and turned to clay, might stop a hole to keep the wind away. Oh, that earth which kept the world in awe should patch a wall to expel the winter flaw. Trash talk. And we too, when we go, are somehow recycled as asphodels, or on a rocky prominence in Tibet in a sky burial, above the tree line with no soil as blanket, dismembered for the vultures, then the bones ground with grain and left for rodents and other creatures. Not the way of the Egyptians, not the way of Americans with our mortuary lobby, not hermetically sealed and permanent, recycled. My friend Dan discovered a garbage dump west of Butte, Montana back in 61. Dug up bottles, all of them from before 1900. 600 all told. He saved them, cleaned them up, and has his own collection / museum. This is archaeology. You come to know a culture by digging through its rubbish pits, what they consumed, how they lived. Go to the Hopi mesas and find their dump. Start sorting. Garbology. What's in Bob Dylan's trash can? Where I was born, in Staten Island, they have a landfill 100 feet deep, covering many acres, called appropriately after its location, Great Kills. Now decommissioned and high rises plan to line the park, which will rest atop the garbage. Every day, 7 days a week, 8 huge barges from Manhattan were unloaded on these grounds. Others taken out to sea, because what did that matter? Now, what percolates halfway down in that lair of molder? I have seen the municipal dump in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, Stung Minh Che, accompanied by a reporter who worked there himself for 2 years after Pol Pot, before he broke those fetters. We met one shy boy of four, still in diapers, picking through medical waste, barefoot. Another, 12, in a requisitioned football helmet, happy as a lark, who'd worked there for the last 7 years. People in makeshift shelters atop the foothills of the garbage. The fires of hell, the stench invading everything. Picking through the refuse for what can be used again. For $1 a day, more than they could make in their home village. In Guatemala City, the same, a separate culture of those consigned to this way of life. And the birds again, the ever-present vultures, the most efficient pickers. What comes around? I have worked on the honey wagon, holding the suction hose at the bottom of a manhole, and emerged in my rubber suit, stinking and shivering in 90-degree heat. In India, I carried gas cans full of cow urine to dump on the ashram compost, which went on our garden, the vegetables we ate every day. I have cleaned up old men who have fouled themselves, as someone one day may do for me. Recycling. I have worked with ex-cons in the storm drains under Iowa City, clearing sludge from huge pipes, and once had to crawl on my knees in a pipe not much wider than my body under the Iowa River, pushing, clearing. Every few days, or every few weeks, my son and I go to the barn and shovel horse manure out onto the fields, dumped on the garden in spring, when the birds take up the strands of horsehair and weave them into nests, gray, black, sorrel, tan. Glorious recycling. Rebar comes into Miller Salvage and winds up then at Peerless Chain, forged into links, disseminated. Some comes back again to the same salvage yard to find its way back to be forged as another chain. Some scrap sent downriver in barges to New Orleans, to Nucor, where it is smelted, exported to China, to India, anywhere, and then back to us in another form. That old beater your dad takes to Badger Foundry, crushed, melted down, shipped out, and may return in the body of your new car, unbeknownst to you. Recycling. Trash. We can only pick through so much of it. Birds may be falling from the sky, but don't think the sky is falling. Live as the birds of the field. Trash. Don't watch it. Don't talk it. Don't let words of anger spill from your heart and then your mouth. Weapons enough. Learn your part by heart, my friend. Pay attention. Sing the blessings deep from your belly, mischief in your smile. The cat, purring at your shoulder as you read this. Do you remember when you knew each other lifetimes ago? Thank you.
Now that you have heard the work of Ken McCullough, it's time to get to know him. We begin our interview with Ken telling us about when he settled in Winona. You're listening to Artbeat with Terry Tenseth.
I moved here in 1996 and have been continually surprised by this amazing landscape and the people here and the community. It's called the Driftless Zone, and I've been a drifter most of my life, but I think this is where the drifting stops.
So you don't see any other movement?
No.
You're going to stick here?
I think so.
Yeah.
You know, even though I really have a close bond with the mountains of Montana and Wyoming, the older I get, the bluffs are high enough at this point.
Who introduced you to Winona itself?
Well, we decided to move up here to possibly find some kind of an intentional community And that's what drew us to the area. We really didn't know what to expect, you know, just on a kind of a whim.
Okay, so you hadn't heard from anybody else about Winona? You just...
Nope, not a word.
Wow.
Not a word.
You do kind of just flow. Well, tell me about growing up and when art became a part of your life, that you were able to put things down.
My father was in the U.S. Air Force. We moved approximately every 2.5 years. We always had a lot of books around. Neither of my parents were smart people, but they weren't intellectuals, but they always had a lot of good books around, good records, particularly of folk songs, that sort of thing, classical music. And I think in the fact of moving around made me, I think I was an observant person anyway, but that made me more observant. Because when you move into a new place, you're the new kid, you'd better adapt. So I learned the accent, I learned the flora, I learned the fauna. I walked around. I found myself when I was a kid in Newfoundland being called even though my father was a staff sergeant with 5 kids, I was a rich American, and so I was wound up having to defend my country. So I think the moving is probably what did it for me. And those images, when you move so frequently, you remember what you've seen much more clearly than possibly if you've been in the same place all your life. At the same time, when I read someone like William Faulkner, who is so entirely steeped in Mississippi, that it just flows out of him. He knows much more than he's aware. I'll never reach that point. But I hope that at some point I can say some things about Winona that at least begin to look in that direction that Faulkner does.
Did your parents first realize your talent, or was it in school that it was recognized?
Well, I think as a kid, I always acted in the school plays, which were not much to speak of. When I went off to boarding school, I was a scholarship student at a place called St. Andrews in Delaware. And I arrived with my one Robert Hall suit and my one pair of shoes. And incidentally, the movie Dead Poets Society was shot at my old school. Early on in the first term, our teacher, who was a very tough guy named Joe Perrott, had us take a Greek myth and rewrite it. And I was just sort of muddling along in the class up to that point, and we came in and he said, "Okay, men, I want to read you something." And he read them my piece. I think it was about Atlas. You know, and this is a guy who wasn't impressed by much. He was impressed by what I had written, and my classmates, who were all, myself included, cynical prep school boys, they were all impressed, and it became part of my persona and remained part of my persona, even at a time in history when you were not encouraged to go into the arts. You were encouraged to become a CEO or a doctor or a lawyer.
Were your parents supportive, though?
Yes.
Okay,
yep.
Well, that's
yep.
nice.
Yep. Yep.
Great. Now, you've accomplished a lot. I mean, I assume you went to college for the literary arts?
Yes and no.
Yes and no? Okay.
I started out as a biology major. My headmaster, I didn't get along with him, he said, "Well, you should go to college and study theater." And it was because he had said that I was not going to do that. It's probably what I should have done. But I started out in biology, and as it turned out, all of the people in the biology department operated out of one half of their brain, the neat and tidy side of their brains, and if you tell them a joke, you would have to explain it. And so I decided this is not for me. And at the same time, I had a double major in English. I bailed out at the 11th hour and wound up going to the writer's workshop at the University of Iowa. And I could not believe that I was getting a degree for sitting around writing poetry and reading. It seemed really absurd.
Yeah. Well, how do you make a living as a poet?
You usually don't. Now and then you may get some kind of grant, which keeps you afloat for a while. And I know that, I'm trying to remember the year, 2003, I was unemployed. During that year, I had time to write. And I finished three books, got them all placed with publishers, and they were published within a year and a half. So you have to sort of pace yourself and make your moves whenever you can. You know, it used to be that I would sit around and I'd have to have a certain kind of pencil and the light had to be just right and I had to eat certain things. But now, if there's 5 minutes, I sit down and I do whatever I can.
Do you use an audio recorder ever to write down thoughts, or do you keep like a journal by the bed?
I keep various journals around. The problem is my handwriting has gotten so terrible that often what I think the words are, they're not. And so they turn out to be much more interesting. The wrong words turn out to be much more interesting than what I wrote down. So it's kind of like reading some mysterious code that the gods have placed on the page.
You went to Cambodia?
Yes. Yeah. I've worked with a Cambodian writer named Usam Er. He lived through the Pol Pot years and was a fairly well-known person. He was a member of parliament, a UN delegate, and we were classmates at Iowa in the writer's workshop. I and several other people worked for about 8 years to get him out of Cambodia, and he came over in 1992 and has been here ever since. I came back in 92.
Now you co-wrote a book with him.
Yeah.
Right.
We translated his poetry, and Coffee House Press published a bilingual edition of that poetry. Several years after that, we worked on his memoir together.
What was that like collaborating, and how did it change you as a writer or a poet?
I think it, particularly in watching Usam perform his poetry, he chants it more than he does recite it. I'm not particularly good at memorizing stuff, but when you live in a prison camp where if you show any indication that you are literate, that you can even read, you know, there are other writers. I know that there's one Russian poet who would take a bar of soap and scratch out the words of the poem in the bar of soap and then rub it out. And so Sam carried that stuff around in his head during the 3.5 years of his imprisonment. That was an important lesson for me to see. And I think the public aspect of poetry, thinking about who your audience is and connecting with them, because often poets, you're sitting around, writers in general, sitting around in isolation. And it gets lonely. So the opportunities you get to present your poetry and work with the public, particularly in a place like Winona, it's a challenge, but it's also a wonderful opportunity. Being poet laureate, I found myself having to write poems about all kinds of things which I probably wouldn't have written about anyway. The poem this morning, you know, about garbage. I had not considered writing that until the Frozen River board approached me and said, would you read a poem at the festival? And I said, well, sure. But of course, I had no idea where it was going to go.
How do you become Winona's poet laureate, or how do you become a poet laureate? And there's only 7 in the state,
yeah,
right?
I don't know what the process is in the other cities, but here, the Fine Arts Council sponsors it. They put out a call, and you have to submit your resume and some writing samples and talk about why you fit the bill. So it's by application.
What would you say to somebody who is in college and they want to do the same thing you're doing?
The first thing I would say is if you're wimpy, don't do it. And I would also say figure out some other kind of job, because chances are, 9 times out of 10, you're not going to make a living as a poet. If you look around, many of our important poets have done other things. You know, Wallace Stevens was in the insurance business. William Carlos Williams was an MD. Many of his poems are kind of skinny because he wrote them on prescription blanks. So I would suggest some other line of work. And this is maybe at this point in time, people have heard this before, but I still think it's true. Work other kinds of jobs. Get some sense of what the real world is like. I live a great deal of my life in my imagination, but I think that you need some stuff to build on. And a lot of that can be as simple as exploring your family and listening to those stories that are around in your family before they disappear. I remember going into a house, an abandoned farmhouse outside of Williamsburg, Iowa. This is maybe 35 years ago. And there was a box of probably 100 glass plate negatives of this family just left. You know, and it was shocking to me that people would leave behind something like that. You know, write down those stories, or at least get them in your head in some way. You know, I have all kinds of ways now of, let's say, for example, if I'm on the road, if I'm driving to Montana, I don't use any kind of GPS stuff. I don't have a gadget that tells me where I am and how many miles to such and such. I might be playing music, but I'll have my atlas there. And invariably, as I'm driving, I'll scribble things on the atlas. So some of my atlases now are just covered with, in my illegible scrawl, of notes for poems. And I have a number of friends who listen to books on tape and find themselves going off onto tangents of their own as they're hearing the work of other writers declaimed in that way.
Did you ever have to work a weird, odd job in between things?
Well, I know just in terms of making ends meet, when my older son was in high school, I would go down and I wouldn't sell blood, but I would sell serum twice a week. And I had a regular 9-to-5 job. I also was one of those annoying telemarketers.
Yeah.
And I would use phony voices so that if I called up people that I actually knew, they wouldn't recognize who it was. But I've had jobs. One time I had a construction job that for several days I was down in the bottom of a manhole cleaning sewers. This was in Philadelphia. When I got on the subway going home, I had a wide swath around me.
Yes. You get all the room you want.
That's
on the
right.
Subway.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, is there anything you want to talk about?
Well, I don't want to sound discouraging about poetry, because I think that the important thing is to start where you are, to present your work to other people, and it may be just sitting around in college in a dorm room that five of you read each other's stuff. Every high school, every college has a literary magazine. It's a place to start. Newspapers, wherever you can, get the work out there, because I think that the important thing is that if you look back at poetry and you look back at song, they were originally the same thing. And there was a kind of magic involved in it, using words in that way. The people who did it were recognized as having certain powers. And if you keep those powers inside, it doesn't work. You know, it may fester and cause you to act in inappropriate ways.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, if you're angry, and if you let it out in your poetry, people will get it. They will understand what's going on, and you will wind up being a much saner person.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
A big thank you to Ken McCullough for taking the time out to share with us here on ArtBeat.
ArtBeat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.